Stuart Lipoff is a communication systems engineer who provides consulting services to clients in the telecommunications, information technology, media, and consumer electronics industries through his company, IP Action Partners Incorporated. He holds Bachelor of Science degrees in electrical engineering and engineering physics from Lehigh University, a Master of Science in electrical engineering from Northeastern, and an MBA from Suffolk University. Mr. Lipoff is an IEEE Fellow and past President of the IEEE Consumer Electronics Society, where he currently serves as Vice President of Publications. Well, now, it's time to get serious with interactive TV. Please welcome Stuart Lipoff.
Thank you, Bill, and good afternoon, everyone. You might guess from looking at the title slide that this is a session on interactive TV. And I think you'll find that I will be true to the topic. However, it's also another story. It's also about the opportunity to reinvent your business. I think everyone probably knows the old story about the railroad companies that thought they were in the transportation business and realized maybe too late that they thought that they were in the tracks and engine business, but realized too late they were in the transportation business. And by the time they did, trucks and air freight and other forms took over. Later on, they did successfully reinvent their business in a certain manner of speaking by leveraging their real estate right away to long-haul fiber optics transport. So sometimes you can gain it back. But there's probably nothing that makes you feel ancient like talking to someone in an earlier generation, 30 years younger, in my case, my son. One day he walked up to me and he said, why does the word dial sometimes precede a published phone number in an ad? And when I managed to rummage around in the basement and I found an old rotary phone, he was fascinated. He took the thing apart. He couldn't believe that such a thing existed. Then we got into a discussion about why music stores were called record companies and so forth. But that discussion with him made me think back to my own youth in the 50s when I remember being homesick one day in bed, and I listened to the Lone Ranger episodes on radio. And of course, radio was very successful in reinventing itself to deal with people listening in their automobiles and all the portable devices with news, talk, and music and different types of programming. And there are lots of other recent examples of reinvention, some successful and some failures. With the recent passing of Steve Jobs, it's a really tremendous case history to look at how he successfully, serially reinvented that business as it was failing and turning it into something else. He started with hobby computers, moved to Mac workstations, which were basically for creative people, too expensive for the typical office, added the Intel processors and operating system, moved it into the mainstream of the Wintel PCs, created iTunes for selling music to iPod devices, a whole new business model, mobile phone business, the store for selling software to iPads, created a tablet business. He had failures as well, but did reinvest and reinvent. In today's broadcasting industry, it's clear the business is not about the development of big sticks and the real estate, the real assets are local presence, brand name, media sales, sourcing, and management of content. However, there still are some real challenges in terms of holding on to the share of eyeballs with all the proliferation of alternate sources of content from cable, satellite, and internet TV. And although this presentation is titled Internet TV, I hope you'll find the topic is equally about the opportunity to reinvent the broadcast business. Some might argue that you can scale up interactive TV using only unicast IP packets delivered by broadband service providers, cable companies, and DSL. But this unicast interactive TV will never be able to scale up to support the current population of people who watch linear TV. Only broadcasting is efficient enough to do that. So I would submit the combination of broadcast content provided with some rather lower bandwidth unicast back channels provides the opportunity to reinvent the broadcast business. And I hope after you listen to what I have to say, you'll agree with me. What I'd like to do here is to start off by just defining the situation. And as you might guess, because we actually can look back some 30 years and find the starting point for this, it's reasonable to ask, is this really an opportunity? Is this really something that's going to happen now? And why might it happen now when it has now been incubating for, say, 30 years? And I would say we have the unusual confluence of a number of things happening. We have intelligence in the consumer devices. starting off with what's in the set-top boxes, whether it's from cable or satellite, and probably soon to be incorporated into many of the smart TVs. We have a first generation of middleware in the form of EBIF, which is really just more of a browser, and then OCAP, which is a Java-powered middleware that's much more flexible, and the broadcasting version of that called ACAP. We have always-on connectivity in the homes and mobile. That is an IP channel that's there all the time, rather than on a dial-up basis. We also have, through the work of the ATSC, their mobile handheld standard, the variation on the ATSC digital A53, the so-called A153 mobile handheld, which many people don't realize until you get into it, there is a Part 5 interactive profile in there, which basically provides for the ability to broadcast URLs, HTML code, and the ability to talk back. So when you begin to think about the possibility of that proliferating into cell phones, all of a sudden you not only have another use for the big sticks that are out there, but you also have the ability to talk back built in. Switch digital video, advanced audience measurement systems, because these systems can talk back, the set-top boxes, is now creating opportunities for very different kinds of advertising, advertising effectiveness, advertising response. And the last question is, does anybody really want to do this? And there's lots and lots of metrics, but this is one that I just love. American Idol, which is, of course, an audience participation program, one of several that are out there. The growth in that thing was just absolutely incredible. Just looking at the year, 1 year from 2008 to 2009, and I only put those numbers up there because they're ones I was able to find, you had more than a doubling in votes that were coming through. Partly, I think, because the program was getting popular, partly because short messaging or texting and phones were out there. But the growth rate and the usage is just really something. So what I'd like to do is I want to show you a vision, one created by Intel for their smart TV. And then we'll take a little look back at history, and we'll see what has been happening. You know, some of the steps along the way that take us up to the present, and maybe get a little insights by looking back, what was actually the evolution, how rapidly it was going, what was inhibiting it going forward, and why this time it might really be right to think about this. So Kevin, if you could start that up as a video and sound. It's a smart TV, yep. And this is an Intel video.
Welcome to Smart TV with the Intel Atom processor. With Smart TV, you'll turn on a new experience you won't want to turn off. Combine your favorite entertainment from television and the internet into an easy-to-use experience. How does it work? Let's say you're watching a show, but you want to channel surf. Instead of scrolling through a list of programs, you bring up the channel wheel with live programming, quickly showing you what's playing on each channel. Find the TV show that interests you and click. You're watching that program. Sometimes you're watching a TV show that features cool products, and you're curious to know more. Smart TV can enable shopping information at the bottom of the screen that will link you to more details, tell you where to buy it, and maybe even include a special offer. It gets even better. If you're passionate about your favorite shows, some TV broadcasters will provide TV extras or suggest other shows you may like. For instance, if you're watching The Big Bang Theory, your Smart TV knows this is something you like and will make recommendations based upon your viewing preferences. You can tell your Smart TV to save the show for later and add it to your playlist. Now, what about online entertainment? There's an amazing amount of content available online, and with your Smart TV, you can access it with your television remote. Using the video wall, or the media wall, you can quickly browse through all your entertainment and information options and find exactly what you're looking for quickly and easily. Still want more? You can use voice searching to quickly find what you want. When you pull up a search bar and say NCIS, your Smart TV will use voice recognition technology to filter television shows and internet content for any media related to NCIS. With Smart TV, watching television now becomes interactive. You can discuss your favorite shows live. If you don't know what you want to watch on TV, reach out to friends or online communities to see what they're watching. and this can happen anywhere in the world. With video conferencing, you can watch a show together with a friend or someone you just met in real time. Don't forget photos and video downloads. You can share content you own with your friends. It's simple. Roll through your video wheel, select your downloaded videos or photos, and send them to a friend. It's sent immediately, and you can review it together at the same time. Welcome to the future of TV. Smart TV is the most comprehensive entertainment experience in your living room, with television, movies, photos, home videos, the internet, and social networking, all within the touch of your remote. You can watch TV on your own, get a suggestion of shows you like, or share what you're watching with your online community. Your TV just got a whole lot smarter.
Thank you, Kevin. Get the slides back up, if you would. This all played seamlessly on my Mac, but but I appreciate Kevin's help. So let's take a look at what was in there. There, first of all, were two different categories of applications. If you aren't familiar with the terms, they're commonly being called bound and unbound applications. I think the bound ones are perhaps of more interest to broadcasters, but there are ways to leverage the unbound ones as well. What bound means is the application is tied to the content that you're seeing on the screen. Responding to an ad that's just came out would be a bound application, or having some social media interaction with a friend while you're watching the program is another form of it. The unbound things would be like, I just want to know what the weather is at the moment. I don't care what I'm watching. But in any event, if you looked at that Intel video and you kind of picked out what are some of the common aspects which would help you define what interactive TV or next generation TV would be, you found applications like interactive advertising, shopping, and video commerce. You found advanced human interfaces such as graphic user interface and voice recognition. There were lots of extra enhancements to linear TV, things where you could drill down for a little bit more content. There was a recommendation engine. It was looking at what you were doing and helping you to make some decisions about what you might want to watch. Not different from, say, what happens today when you do catalog shopping and they look at your last order, or Amazon, who recommends books to you. There is access to online internet content on the TV screen. Some cases bound to the program, some cases you could move away from the program. There was all the social networking and video conferencing and the sharing of content, video and other content. So this has been a common vision, actually, of internet TV for quite a while. This is the front cover of a magazine that of Newsweek that I like to pull up to remind me that we maybe we've been waiting a long time. This magazine is July 3rd, 1978, and it's got some of my favorite stuff in there. You can see the kid in the foreground laying there in the shag rug with the belly telly watching something different from the parents who are in front of a console, and we'll blow some of that stuff up in a moment. You can also see way in the background to the right someone in the family using a video camera to film the parents, and over there to the left, a video game, a projection TV, and this sort of thing. The interesting thing about this particular slide, this artist rendition of 1978, was every piece of equipment that's up there, the VCR, the video disc, the computer, the Warner Cube terminal that I'll show you, was existing technology at the time. In fact, the front cover of my presentation was from a book called Talkback TV, published in 1976. And it talked about a trial that took place near where I live in Dennisport, Massachusetts, by Rediffusion in 1971. It was a trial of video on demand, again, arguably one of the first forms of interactive TV, where a twisted pair carried a Channel 2 54 megahertz RF from the head end, which was a Strowger switch, to the home, and you use one of those rotary dials to select which program you wanted to read. So it was switch video over twisted pair in the form of RF. I'm sure the FCC Part 15 requirements would not be met today, but let's take a look at some of the stuff that's in here. This is the Warner Cube terminal. During this time frame, In the 70s, there were franchise wars taking place, as people called them, where you would go in and have a beauty contest with the local franchising authority as a cable company, and we would try and convince them that they'd be getting some technology that could do wondrous things. Of course, the cable companies didn't tell you at the time that the cost and feasibility of actually scaling this up for large scale was not practical, but at that point, all they really wanted to do was get the license. Nonetheless, it demonstrated the ideas, and this stuff actually worked. What you can see here are 12 buttons on the left-hand side and three columns. And you can select regular programming, broadcast programming on the right side, I believe. The center was called community, and the left was premium programming, which was pay-per-view. This was a two-way system over coax. There was no fiber in it, but they could tell which button you were pressing and could bill you for what you end up selecting. So push the premium button on the left and push one of the buttons on the left-hand side and you order a movie. You also see five response buttons on the right-hand side, which allowed you to respond to, say, questions that were up there on the screen. Typically, the questions were broadcast, so they would be something like a talking head would be interviewing the mayor of the town, and then he would turn to the audience and say, I just asked him a question, how many people think they answered? He answered it, you know, push one if you think he did, two if you think he's lying, three if you don't think he did. And, you know, you kind of get immediate response to the politician real time. It didn't go over too popular with the city authorities after they authorized it, but that was one of the early applications, was the opinion polling and the response. And also in the upper right-hand corner, there's a little message light that tells you that there is some message waiting for you, which you can end up retrieving by the right combination of buttons. So this was one of several things that were going on at the time. Japan was doing some stuff near Osaka with Higashiya Koma, Tammy Newtown, a precursor to what became Gerald General Instrument. A company called Tocom was doing stuff in Irving, Texas, that all involved devices such as this. Over here on the right-hand side is a partially cut-off Commodore PET computer that did have a dial-up modem in it and the ability to talk back by going into the bulletin boards, again, pre-internet at the time, but there was interactivity provided. There was a LaserDisc player. This was a 12-inch, 30-centimeter kind of, you know, big disc that actually was analog FM recorded on it, but fairly high quality, but allowed you to do all sorts of interactive features, such as individual still frame, stop play, and it had programming built in it for stored branch and control. So one of the things, for example, was the board game Clue, you know, Miss Scarlet in the attic with a pipe, that sort of thing. There were games that were brought out that allowed you to use a remote control, interact with the microcomputer programming and the still video, and the ability to do stop action and play scenes and music. And so you had a full multimedia capability, again, back in this time frame of 78. The Atari 2600 VCS video game, basic video game, but they actually had a cartridge at the time that had a telephone jack on it that allowed you to use it as a rudimentary terminal device to access, I think it was CompuServe or the Source or one of those other things. So again, another example. So that's 78, but 78 actually is late history. 1953 maybe is the earliest thing we could kind of look back in the historical perspective and find interactivity. Winky Dinks was a program where you sent away a few bucks to the program provider, the local station, and they would mail you a acetate screen, a flexible screen that you were supposed to put over the TV and some greasy crayons, and the program material would be something like, Winky Dinks is stuck on the one side of the river and he needs to get across to get away from the bad guy. So draw a bridge, kids, across the river, and you're supposed to take your crayon and go up to it and draw the bridge. I think, again, this is pre-color, so they weren't worried about X-ray radiation. But I think what probably ended up killing this more than anything else was a lot of the kids didn't put the screen on the TV, and I think the parents probably... just a few years ago at the International Conference on Consumer Electronics, we recognized the inventor of the remote control, who was from Zenith. And what's kind of interesting about this is this was really nothing more than a flashlight. And each of the four corners of the TV had photo sensors, where you could just flash the corner of the TV and you could turn it on or off and bring the volume up or down or move commercials and mute it. But you can see from the text that's up there, the one thing they're talking about is you can shut off long, annoying commercials while a picture remains on the screen. Wasn't particularly popular, I think, at the time with the advertising-supported broadcasters that Zenith was into, but even back then in 1956, interactivity was something that people were beginning to get experience with and find of some value. Moving forward a bit past the 78, in 1988, GTE, now Verizon, introduced a service called Main Street. They provided a cable TV set-top box, which was just a conventional tuner, but it also had in it on one of the channels a freeze frame and the ability to look at the, like teletext, look at the address of the frame being transmitted. So you could use a remote control to select from the menu something that you were interested in. And when the frames, which were being broadcast at 30 a second, came around that was marked with the address of what you're interested in, it would get frozen and display on the screen. And you can see from the menu here, a lot of this is broadcast information. However, it also, as you can see, had a phone line connection. And once you had gone through the first level of menus and had selected the stuff that was largely of general interest to everybody, you could then click on it, and seamlessly, it would place a phone call using a telephone connection and dial-up modem, and would convert that to graphics overlays using, in some cases, the broadcast freeze frame to overlay it. So, you know, here you had a commercial service that was out there for actually about 5-6 years before it eventually was pulled back by the cable companies and they moved on. Philips CDI player is another interesting kind of interactive TV history story. It had a long gestation period. It was released for sale in 91, although there were a lot of trials up till then. And in fact, before being released for sale, there were versions of this where they didn't put the CD in it, but they used a multi-port on the back to connect to a DSL phone line down in Arlington, Virginia, and they actually did some video on demand stuff with MPEG video. But the basic product here had a standard five and a quarter inch CD. In fact, it was one of the, I think they called it the white book standard or yellow book standard. You know, they had white, yellow, green book standards. One of them was the, they're all the same physical CD, but this one had still video, music, audio, and later on they actually added MPEG-1 digital video, which required a coprocessor that you plugged in the back of this. There was an operating system based on the Motorola 6800 processor, and this basically allowed you to do anything from very sophisticated video games to educational and touring things. One of the examples was a tour of Florence, Italy, an art tour, where you'd have voice over captioning and you could basically navigate your way in using a joystick you could see up at the top to go through the museums and stop in front of a painting and get some information about it. So it wasn't just pure entertainment, but it certainly was an interactive device and had communications capability as well, either through DSL, and some of the models had a telephone dial-up modem where it operated as a thin client terminal to access some of the services such as Microsoft Web TV, where you could check your email and go further. So it was a pretty general purpose device. Moving forward a little bit, around 1999, Replay and TiVo both introduced. They each fight with each other as who was first, but they certainly were DVRs and. These not only allowed you to pause real time and, this sort of thing, but they also downloaded their own advertising to these devices, which they played when it was idle or you were fast-forwarding. The more recent devices have recommendation engines built in that look at your history and what you're doing and then begin to make suggestions about what you want to watch. Time Warner Cable had down in Orlando a operational commercial service in 94 called the Full Service Network. It was an ATM switch that allowed video on demand with a digital video being switched by the ATM, but also included shopping, other forms of interactivity, and telephony over the same service. And I don't know how many people remember this. This is a patent in 99, but this service actually went live. There was a company called TV Answer who partnered with Hewlett-Packard. This is a drawing from their patent. Hewlett-Packard made the little battery-powered remote control in their calculator division. It kind of looked like a calculator, but a 218 megahertz transmitter in it. And you could watch broadcast TV on an enabled channel, and then you could interact or send a message back to the station, responding typically, again, to opinion polls. So they would ask you, you know, what you liked or disliked. They would also have you, like, call football plays, you know, pass or run, and then they would put up the on the screen what the vote is, and then, of course, you could see what it actually was. This actually got implemented in a number of bars and this sort of thing, but didn't end up going much further. I want to move now much closer into the present, and what this slide is these are a series of still shots that I'm going to blow up on the on each of the slides from a brochure that was put out by Qualcomm. This was something called the Media Flow Service. They bought Channel 55 rights from the FCC in an auction, and they bought a lot of the transmitters from people who were using it. They broadcast a non-ATSC compatible signal, but it was a digital signal using MPEG-4, and the business model was this would be marketed by the cellular carriers, Verizon being one of them, and you'd pay a subscription fee. There was some advertising-supported content, some pay-to-view content, and a variety of other things. This particular brochure represents interactivity that was never actually implemented, as far as I know, with Media Flow. The only thing they actually did was one way, but this was part of their vision. And the reason I'm showing you this to you is it could easily say this is the vision for ATSC MH, because basically the same technology, the same sort of screens, using, again, MPEG-4, but a slightly different underlying physical layer. So I think looking at what Qualcomm had in mind for the interactivity with this will give you some idea as to what may be coming down the road as ATSC MH A153 rolls out. So here's the personalized home screen where, again, you're looking at some broadcast content in the background, but you've got, you know, HTV, view, weather, and news, and this sort of stuff in terms of what people are calling widgets at the bottom of the screen. There's a unified program guide that you can basically go through and select what's in there. And, of course, they get, because it's a two-way service, even though you're selecting a program guide, you immediately get some feedback back at the program source about what people are watching and when they can be used for analytics for advertising sales. There are IP data services, which are unbound, you know, types of things. Here we're looking at the weather. Interactive advertising, where the advertising is being broadcast, but you can end up interacting with it by, you know, win free gear, and it'll bring up something that allows you to enter your email address or it, depending on the relationship you have with the subscriber, they'll know who you are by just clicking on it. There's the social media stuff that we saw in the Intel Vision. Here you're watching a program, but you can have your friends online and you can do some chat with them real time. There's marketing where users determine what the content will be, and you can vote on what you want to hear, and then, you know, they'll play it. Again, more social networking, where you can again interact with the system. I think you get the idea. You have some ratings where people are looking at how popular a particular show is at any one time as maybe you're surfing through. And then program reminders, when you queued something up that you want to watch, it'll tell you that it's coming up and it's there. And finally, this is, of course, not something on the screen, but these are some of the usage metrics that the broadcaster would end up seeing that could be used for enhancing the quality of the advertising effectiveness and perhaps getting a larger share of revenue. So I showed you the Intel Vision, which is something that's not really quite real. However, the Yahoo did interact with Intel with something that they call the Confabulator Engine, that is built into a number of TVs. I've been showing it for the last 3 years at the Consumer Electronics Show, and it involves a series of widgets that are down at the bottom
Kevin, if I could ask you to play the video for this again. This runs silently, but I'll narrate a little bit. It just shows you what happens as you're watching, say, standard TV, and then the widgets can appear down at the bottom, and you can interact with it by using your remote control. And so Blockbuster, Facebook, Flickr, this sort of thing. This was is typically unbound applications because the TV has internet connection, it's receiving an off-the-air broadcast. But Yahoo last year at least showed a two-screen kind of idea where you could be broadcasting over the internet a small version of what you see on the TV, and you could actually tie, put the PowerPoint back up. You could actually tie what you were watching on the TV and broadcasting to the internet connection coming back. So again, this is real technology that's on the market that people can buy today, and the connected TVs are gonna kind of continue to evolve, I think, to some large extent. So let's kind of review where we are today. We have Yahoo connected TV and connected TVs of various forms, smart TVs, non-standardized of various forms, that are gonna be doing, have internet connections. Some of them will support the home networking standards which are developing that allow you to access content throughout the home and then also to services outside the home. Smartphones already, which are video enabled, and the next generation beyond media flow is almost certainly gonna be the ATSC-MH. Currently, there are various unicast services like Mobi TV, where you subscribe to an IP stream, but again, these things don't scale well, and they use more bandwidth than the carriers typically have available. Video-enabled PCs, in this case, they're mainly unicast IP, but there are USB and various cards that also include broadcast tuners in them, and I predict that as ATSC-MH rolls out on you broadcasters, you're going to see more and more of these plugged into the PC because they, first of all, provide very high-quality signal with an antenna that's less robust than you typically need for conventional ATSC, and they can handle the multipath. But they also have this Part 5 interactive profile, and, of course, the PC typically has a return channel. So in addition to some of this ATSC-MH stuff being on the mobile and handheld, you're probably likely to find it on PCs, which will start with accessory USB tuners typically plugged in the side, and ultimately over time, just as Wi-Fi ended up getting built on the motherboard, I think you're beginning to find some of that too. All sorts of multiple platforms now that are capable of supporting interactivity. We have the connected TVs, we have various dedicated appliances, Boxy, Apple TV, and others, which sit between the internet and the TV. Game consoles, which and Blu-ray players, both of which have internet connections on them, and are capable of doing more than multiplayer games. As you know, you can access Hulu and a Blockbuster content with some of these, and of course the set-top and satellite set-top boxes that have a very powerful Java-based Java engine in them with the middleware, so that using that middleware, the open cable, sometimes called TrueTV or OCAP, open cable application platform, you can write applications that'll run on anybody's box, being independent of the hardware. That's the purpose of being the middleware. I want to talk a little bit more just about the middleware as I begin to get to the end of this and conclude. Not too long ago, there were a number of set-top devices and boxes that incorporated various different forms of proprietary middleware. Again, because the important thing to note here is that there are a lot of them. And unfortunately, because there are a lot of them, you don't have the economies of scale associated with being able to write these applications, which, you know, consume a great deal of effort. As you know, with something like the iPad and the Android, when you have these, you know, small number of standards that are out there that people can write software to, all of a sudden you attract a large number of developers who start developing stuff. So what's happened is that largely incubating in Europe, starting with this MHP activity under the DVB consortium. We have a number of different generations of the middleware, which evolved to here in the US through Cable Labs into OCAP 1.0 and OCAP 2.0. There you can see coming off the gem line here in the middle, the a variation on OCAP called ACAP, which was designed to go into the consumer electronics TVs, the broadcast TVs. As far as I know, that currently is not going anywhere, but neither is OCAP. It's still a little too expensive to roll out, but as the cost for memory and processing start to drop, you're starting to see at least some experimentation with it, and that takes you a next level of intelligence in these set-top devices that I predict will vastly accelerate the development of some of these interactive applications in these set-top boxes. So I started with the question. The title of this is Time to Get Serious with Interactive TV, and it might as well have a question mark after it. Is it time to get serious with this? Is this something we should really take seriously now? Is this an idea that whose time will come? And what I'd like to suggest to you is that sometimes it can just seem to take forever as we try and push something up the hill, overcoming the inhibitors. You may not have the infrastructure. You need to have the broadband connections to the home. You need to have enabling standards, a small number of them, not a large number of them. The technology has to be good enough. If you go back and you take a look at Main Street, while it produced pretty nice pictures, when you're communicating at 300 bits per second over a dial-up phone line, it's hard to give users that kind of fast interactive response. But when you have tens of megabits per second broadband connections into the home, it's a different story. The government can either help or hinder, and largely they've hindered, at least in development with interactive TV. Currently, probably the biggest problem at the moment is privacy standards, and maybe to a second extent what they're calling open internet or net neutrality. They are trying to help and they are trying to do the right thing, but by creating these legal risks and uncertainty with rules that are not really well thought out, it's creating a real problem with trying to figure out, you know, what form of interactivity can we do? Can we really monitor what subscribers are watching and report to our advertisers the analytics associated with this? And for any of you who might want to think about promoting this and making this happen, you might want to get a hold of your government affairs and legal people and maybe rattle their cage a little bit about being able to lobby the Federal Trade Commission, who's heavily into the privacy thing, and the FCC, who is dealing with some of these net neutrality issues. The content side, you got to have the interactive content. I mean, you know, if you look at the development of television and some of the early pioneers and their vision of what they thought people were going to be doing with TV, and they were going to be, the camera was going to be the audience of a theater, you know, filming a stage production. I mean, that was the vision. And of course, you know, the creative people came to bear and figured out things to do. You need some incubation time and soak time for the creative people to think about how can you use a back channel from the subscriber back to the station and the content provider and your advertisers in a way that you know, attracts people, makes business sense, you know, is reasonable and everything else. And you got to design that content, you know, consistent with the limitations and everything else. And finally, maybe, I don't know, maybe it's the most important thing, it's a social acceptance thing. The idea of linear, you know, layback TV where people get in the room and do it. And, you know, if somebody were to pull out an interactive device or a PC or a tablet, you know, 10, 15 years ago, they'd be regarded as at the least odd and perhaps rude. And today, you know, all the kids are sitting there around the TV and even with the family, you know, with their own smartphone and you know, doing some form of interaction, texting to friends, and whether watching stuff or playing on the Xbox. And the idea that this is kind of part of the mainstream of society is really there. So I think I would submit that we have accelerators now which can get this thing to the top of the hill and maybe create that snowball effect. Once you overcome the initial barriers, the reality is that these things, if they're popular, they grow like crazy. And broadcasting itself is particularly amenable to network effects. That is where the doubling of the number of people who are into it makes it not just twice as valuable, but you know, to some power, like four times valuable. The four times make it 16 times more valuable because of the way that you have the one-to-many associated with it. All the synergies associated with the various parts of the business. It's good for the advertisers, the broadcasters, the content providers. It involves more revenue and more opportunities for everybody. And of course, it creates competition because there's competition out there, and there's satellite and cable and internet TV and broadcasting and every other form of modality, physically delivered stuff. That tends to accelerate innovation and people doing things. And finally, the economies of scale. You make these things, whether they're set-top boxes or internet-connected TVs in large volume, the costs drop rapidly. So let's review here on my last slide what I'm calling the playing field. So you have a bunch of different, on the left-hand side, these delivery modalities. You have real-time wired network services, typically you know, cable or DSL or fiber optics to the home, and where Verizon is serving it. You have real-time wireless network services, the 3G and 4G services. And you also have, as a delivery modality, intelligent consumer premise devices, which may or may not be networked to the outside world or the internet. They may be networked to other devices within the home, or they might incorporate some aspect of wired and intelligence in them. But then you look at the bound applications, and I'm focusing on the bound versus the unbound ones, because I think as broadcasters, that's where the sweet spot is, at least initially. There really are two different kinds of interactive applications. If you think about interactivity, you kind of wonder about what is this thing to the right? You know, well, so one form of interactivity is where the subscriber actually initiates the interaction. He's responding proactively to advertising, to opinion polling. He's watching a CNN news story or local news story, and he wants more information about it and does a deep dive into it to get some still frames or some other footage. There's gaming. There's content determination, that is back to the jukebox, which song do you want to play, or how should the movie end, should it end happy or sad? And then there's subscriber-generated content. A subscriber can upload some of their own videos or audios or, you know, or other information or games. System-initiated are ones where the system is basically watching you kind of passively, but it's responding to what you're doing with interactivity, making use of two-way and return channels. And in some respects, it's not immediately obvious that you'd include this in an interactive TV kind of list, but it's maybe some of the most important. Passively looking at what you're doing and the audience measurement. Again, with today's privacy rules, you got to aggregate the data to a higher enough level of samples so that you can't pull it back to an individual subscriber unless you have their permission or opt-in. And there are different various forms of how that's going to develop. It's still up in the air. Synthetic channels, you know, what that basically is, it knows who you are. It knows who you are based upon what you watched or your demographics or the neighborhood that you're living in and ends up delivering a channel to you that you may think is MTV, but if you're a child of the baby boomers 60s, you're going to hear the oldies and you're going to hear heavy metal if you're a later generation. So end up, again, having something where the content, not just the advertising, is profiled you know, to you. Advertising insertion, of course, we see it today already, you know, in the cable where they're given avails to put stuff in, but it can get much more personalized, again, down to based upon what you've been watching or what they know about you or what you may have opted into. Content advice, recommendation engines, this is what you should be watching. And then not just content pull, like video on demand where you select what you want, but actually pushing content to you, you know, based upon, again, what it may know about you or profile or preferences that you may have entered. So I hope you'll walk away from this both being sober about the fact that we've had a very long gestation period for this, but also being hopeful that this is technology that really is very different than the lean-back linear programming that we're used to today. And that if your creative mind is working, and I'm sure it is, you can probably think about ways in which this may really re-energize both local and network broadcasting in a way that one-way TV can't. So I thank you for your time and hope you found this of interest. I guess there's time for questions. A couple minutes.
So are there any, which body or are there any bodies working on standards for a broadcaster to provide enhanced content aimed at a smart TV?
Yeah, so I mean the ATSC A153 standard is already got some of that in there. I don't know to what extent people envision that being something that people are going to largely use only on mobile phones or portable or battery-powered devices or in the back of a car. I think that was the impetus for pushing it. But if you go to the Consumer Electronics Show, in fact, NAB, last couple of years, you saw a whole bunch of tuners, ATSC MH tuners that were designed for stationary applications. So I think there's at least that. What I don't know, and maybe someone in the room does, whether somebody is trying to go back to the ATSC A53 standard, the conventional ATSC digital broadcast standard, and try and put that in there. But Yahoo Intel collaboration, it's not a industry standard, but it's they're two very large groups, and that's been adopted as a connected TV platform that you find in Samsung and LG TVs and that sort of thing. It's an internet jack on the back of the TV with a browser on it. But if you begin to tie some of the content that's broadcast over the screen to widget that's on the bottom, you have some interactivity. So I think the standard side of this and what's shaking down is still unsettled.
Is North America, are we the leaders in this? Are we the critical thinkers and the creative top pulling everybody else along, or are we Johnny come latelys?
Yeah, well, I guess it depends on which, my last slide here, which segment you're kind of into. We're way behind on the wireless side. You go to Korea in particular or Japan, and every phone that's out there has got a TV tuner in it and the ability to watch over-the-air broadcast TV using, again, a different variants of the standard and a back channel and the ability to do interactivity. And, of course, we're also, in terms of broadband penetration in the home, we're not as far along as Korea and Japan and other places. So at least in terms of proliferation of broadband to fixed locations, high-speed IP to phones and video in the phones, we're way behind. In terms of deployment of intelligent set-top boxes, at least with the precursor to the true two-way, the so-called EBIF, which is a if you really get into it, it's actually just a browser built into the set-top box, but it still allows you to get a lot of the interactive experience in the same way that browser on your PC does. It just puts the intelligence back at the head end rather than in the set-top box the way it does with OCAP. So that's pretty widely proliferated. Most of the cable companies have deployed some version of that. You can see that on their remote controls. They'll ask you to go to their interactive channel during a broadcast to order a pizza or respond to a thing. So it's mixed. I'd say I'm most excited about the opportunity in the intersection with the broadcasting space with the mobile wireless devices, because that's one place that you can't put a wire or fiber. You still need that radio link. And it kind of makes the tower investment and the transmitter investment that you guys have uniquely suited to doing that. It may not be the only way people are gonna watch it, but if they're gonna walk around mobile with some untethered device, they're gonna need to do that. And I think that can re-energize it. I really do, I believe in it.
So if the web-enabled content takes somebody away to order that pizza, do those eyeballs come back?
Yeah, that's a question people keep asking about. But I guess maybe you don't maybe you don't care a lot if, well, first of all, let's say it could be picture in picture, so you still got the other thing that's up there. And if you're getting a piece of the transaction revenue, it's not such a bad business model. Remember, you know, American Express and Visa and MasterCard associations, they take anywhere between 1.5% to 3% of what you're buying with that thing. So if you put yourself as a TV station, you know, maybe doing it yourself, a clearing, or you become a partner with a bank, and you're getting some piece of that transaction revenue of people buying things through there, that's a whole new revenue stream. It's not just, you know, you can sell the advertising for more than you sell now because you can target it and you can measure the effectiveness. And then if somebody buys something, you get a piece of what they buy. I mean, you know, not different today from the syndicated things where you dial the 800 number to buy the bulletproof pantyhose or something like that, you know, but it still can be some pretty good money.
Thank you very much, Stuart.
Okay.